I am a bit tired of seeing billionaires trying to buy political power.
Another billionaire has entered the 2020 race. And this time, this billionaire, Tom Steyer, is running to be the Democratic Party nominee. Now, naturally, Bernie Sanders had something to say about this. So he was on MSNBC with Andrea Mitchell, where he was asked about Tom Steyer entering the race.
Tom Steyer, the billionaire who's made a cause of impeachment, what do you think about him entering the race with all of his money?
Well, you know, I have known Tom for a number of years, and I like Tom personally. But I do have to say, as somebody who in this campaign has received 2 million campaign contributions, averaging, I believe, $19 a person, I am a bit tired of seeing billionaires trying to buy political power. So I like Tom. He is a good guy. He's a friend of mine. But I'm not a great fan of billionaires getting involved in the political process.
So he should not be taken seriously as a candidate, you think?
No, I didn't say that. Look, if you are a billionaire by definition, you are taken seriously. But I think the American people understand that one of the great problems facing American society today is that we have a billionaire class which is getting richer and richer, while the working class of this country is struggling and, in fact, has been decimated over the last 45 years. And people are sick and tired of big money in politics. People want to overturn Citizens United. In my view, we've got to move to public funding of elections. Billionaires, and this is not just Tom Steyer, billionaires should not be able to spend unlimited sums of money trying to buy elections.
And that's exactly right. Now, Tom Steyer actually, look, from what I know of him, he's one of the better billionaires, if that's possible. But that doesn't mean that he should be able to buy himself into a Democratic primary. This is a guy who is not a lawmaker. He's a billionaire. And he thinks because he has all this wealth, well, that means it's okay for him to run for president. He is the perfect example of what we should not want. You do not want somebody who's been able to game the system this way and be able to make this much wealth for themselves. So even if Tom Steyer has some of the right positions, it doesn't mean that he has the correct worldview. And it definitely doesn't mean that you can actually trust him to fight for any of any progressive position. Now, the real issue here is if a teacher had the same ability, a teacher or, I don't know, a nurse, somebody with a normal job had the same ability to enter the Democratic primary race as Tom Steyer did, well then, okay, we can have a debate on whether it's okay for a billionaire to enter the race. But that isn't the case. Your average teacher, your average worker is not able to just enter the Democratic primary at will because they don't have money. They don't have the ability to be on television the same day they announce. So this is the problem with this whole process. I don't have anything against Tom Steyer because he's a billionaire. He gamed the system that exists. The issue is the actual system. The issue isn't really Tom Steyer. But the problem here is that when you can't have the average person entering a Democratic primary, then why should a billionaire be able to? It doesn't make any sense. Now, Tom Steyer here is pledging to spend $100 million in his campaign. I'm still unclear on whether that means it's his money, $100 million of his money, or that means he wants to raise $100 million. But it sounds like it's going to be $100 million of his money, which, I mean, already, if you combine Bernie, Buttigieg, Harris, Warren, and Biden, combine them all together, I don't think it reaches $100 million, at least so far. So this, I really hope that this doesn't matter, because when we get to so to actually qualify for the debate in September, so there's no way he's going to make the July debate, but to qualify for the debate in September, he needs to hit 2% in 4 qualifying polls and have 130,000 donors. Now, a lot of candidates right now have not hit that. Tom Steyer, he'll have to, look, I guess it's possible he can hit 2% in 4 polls. I don't know. But the number here, like, he would need 130,000 donors, individual donors. Now, I thought, who the hell would give Tom Steyer money? Who would willingly give a billionaire money for their presidential campaign? And then I saw this from NBC News. While he is not well known and the candidate field is already overstuffed with 24 candidates, Steyer's money could give him an edge, as could the extensive email list of 8.3 million names compiled by a group he founded to push for the impeachment of President Donald Trump. That will be a factor here. He has 8.3 million people in an email list. People give money through email lists. These things work. I mean, you saw it, at least at the beginning, you saw it even work for Beto. When Beto launched his campaign, he was able to raise a lot of money in the first day and then completely went away. But Bernie's able to do it, and he actually has a real message, so he's been able to maintain his fundraising. But I mean, 8.3 million emails is not something to scoff at. So he has the ability here to maybe have 130,000 donors, unfortunately, to maybe make the debate. And if he makes the debate, then he'll raise in popularity because people know who he is. But aren't you tired? Aren't you tired? I'm tired on multiple levels. I'm tired of this group of people, these candidates. There's way too many candidates. But on top of that, I'm tired of people with so much money thinking that they're entitled to positions of power when they have not earned them. You want people in these positions where they're supposed to represent you. You want people in those positions that actually do represent you, that understand what life is like for the average person, that have experienced real struggles. So just, I'm done with these billionaires, with Tom Steyer, with this entire field of mostly no names. I'm looking forward to maybe like October, November, December, January, where hopefully the field will be cut down to maybe 5 candidates, 6 candidates. I'm looking forward to that, because then that's when the actual race begins.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Brother Brian Mandis. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. I'm going to do another composite episode with this one because there's just so much stuff going on. But I'm going to limit it, the theme at least, to kind of the stuff that has been surrounding the debates. So this is another 2019.06 episode, because the chessboard is really setting itself up wonderfully. If you thought that the field couldn't get any more ludicrous, here comes Tom Steyer. Now, look, I'm not in any fashion trying to say that this man is not genuine in his desire to be president. But honest to God, let's look at this from the chessboard. Let's look at this from the chessboard. When I first heard that Tom Steyer was entering the field, my first question was, who is he? Then I, got some more information on him. I said, wait a minute. Why is he getting into the race now? Why is he getting into the race now? Well, obviously, he's getting into the race partly, I think, because of Joe Biden is just absolutely failing, and for God's sake, somebody please get him off the stage. It is tragic. I mean, I'm a big believer in symbolism. I am a huge believer in symbolism. And every time when I see Joe Biden talk now, and there is no cohesiveness to what he's saying, and he's like skipping from words and thoughts to a disjointed portion of whatever he was saying, I think this is capitalism in its very, very, very detrimentally late stages. Capitalism doesn't have a cohesive message. It just says, do what I've been telling you. So Joe Biden represents that wonderfully. But Tom Steyer is obviously here. It has obviously stepped into this arena to act almost like a representative for his class. Again, I'm not saying that this man doesn't have genuine aspirations, that he's not a good guy. But it does not look good for him to be a billionaire stepping into the game this late and pretty much buying his way onto the debate stage. From the chessboard side point, from the chessboard analogy, the man obviously is stepping in as a representative of the upper elite, because Joe Biden isn't cutting it. Kamala Harris has just been completely eviscerated. Her bleeding corpse is by the side of the way now. It's bad with her. And she knows it. She knows it. But her ego won't tell her to quit. Maybe even there's people behind her with money who's telling her not to quit either. Now, I think it's important. I want to read something, because most of us don't know anything about Tom Steyer, and I want to just read a little bit from his People Over Profits PDF plan. You can go to his website, tomsteyer.com, to find this if you want to read more. But this is how he opens up his economic agenda, People Over Profits. I'm a progressive and a capitalist. But unchecked capitalism produces market failures and economic inequalities. Our economic system provides Americans freedom of choice. That's a lie. Fosters innovation and competition. That second one is definite. Hell, both of those are pretty much lies. The United States has fallen behind in so many scientific categories that it's laughable. China has built a missile that can sink tankers. The United States has nothing that can compare to it. Why? Because China is actually about defense. I'm not praising China. But they're about defense and not money-making. When you take the money-making idea out of building for defense, you get more innovation. Anyway, again, our economic system provides Americans freedom of choice, fosters innovation and competition, rewards ingenuity and hard work. We know that just is not true. So he starts off with fallacies immediately, continuing, and is the most efficient way to generate sustained economic growth and productivity. Okay. Unchecked capitalism hijacks our democracy for the benefit of big corporations, writes rules that ultimately limit competition to maximize corporate profits, squeeze the middle and working classes, notice nobody likes to still talk about the lower classes, exacerbates racial and gender income and wealth disparities, starves the government of resources, and undermines the foundations of the markets. So this is the opening. The people must be in charge of our economy, but socialism isn't the answer. Putting people in charge requires an economic framework built on the three core principles. I call the people over profits economic agenda. So framework built on the three core principles, I call him the people over profits economic agenda, breaking the corporate stranglehold on government, investing in the American people, and harnessing innovation and competition. Now, none of this sounds new. None of this sounds new. This was supposed to take place back in the 60s and the 50s, ladies and gentlemen. And what do you know, within less than 20 years, in fact, when if we look at it from the standpoint of the 60s, people over profits was out the door. Hell, we even have a movie that gave us a really good quote. What quote was that? Greed, for the lack of a better word, is good. Let me continue with this a little bit. In his Breaking the Corporate Stranglehold section, corporate power must never exert undue influence and control over our economy and democracy. My people over profits economic agenda advances the economic and civic value of shared prosperity above the pursuit of monetary profit. When corporations threaten this value, they and their executives must be held accountable by a government of the people. We must enact new laws and strictly enforce existing rules to hold corporate power in check. People over profit economic agenda requires that American economic productivity and sustained economic growth is rooted in the health and welfare of its workers. Our auto workers, public service workers, teachers, teamsters, nurses, and communication workers, our brothers and sisters in labor, my economic agenda clearly recognizes labor's place in our economy. Unchecked capitalism takes away workers' health care, dismantles pension programs, and curtails workplace protection. Hard-fought labor victories that must be built upon, not reversed. I'm not saying this man is not genuine in what he's saying. I have to say that because, but this sounds good. The problem is it sounds like Obama. Now, maybe ultimately Mr. Steyer, because he knows how the corporate world works, maybe he'd be able to actually do something about this. But we have been through the long night of capitalism, and people are tired of it. So he offers some bullet points, and I want to go I want to go into these bullet points just a very tiny bit. Under my people over profits economic agenda, I will, one, establish a national referendum process in congressional term limits, repeal Citizens United, restructure the Federal Elections Commission, and make it easier to vote. We all need that. That's a positive. However, that doesn't have anything to do with economics. Number two, foster the growth and organizational strength of our public and private sector labor unions. And we need more labor unions. Okay, fine. Growth, fine. Number three, pass a federal $15 an hour minimum wage and expand the earned income tax credit and retirement security programs. So here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. What Mr. Steyer is pretty much doing is he's pulling a slight FDR with this. And what I mean by a slight FDR is these are things that the more progressive, put that in quote, billionaires have been telling the other stupid billionaires. And I don't put that in quote. I highlight that, make it big, and circle it. Billionaires that they need to do for the last 30 years. They've been telling them, you need to institute these things or else you're going to destabilize the society enough where they're just going to say to hell with capitalism. But these stupid, again, highlight that, circle it, make it big, billionaires who are all about their money, they don't listen. So now it's up to Mr. Steyer to come out and say, all these things that we've been telling them to do for the last 30 years, they didn't want to do, but now they're begging because Bernie Sanders is knocking on the door of the White House. And now they're begging to have them done because they see. They can talk about Elizabeth Warren getting bigger and bigger crowds. I love that, by the way. I've heard many media outlets talk about that. Oh, Elizabeth Warren, she's getting bigger and bigger crowds today. Bernie Sanders, when he held pretty much his comeback rally with AOC, 25,000 people, I imagine over 25,000 people, I've seen those pictures, showed up. These people now see socialism knocking on the door and they're afraid. So they sent out somebody like Mr. Steyer to try to put out the fire. Okay, fine. We'll give you the $15 an hour. Okay. We'll strengthen and grow the unions. Okay, fine. We'll get the national referendum system that you've been wanting, that you've been begging us to pass. Fine, we'll do that. We'll set congressional term limits. Trust us. We'll even repeal Citizens United. Just God, take the socialism away. Just take the socialism away. And we'll do all of this. We swear. I mean, we kind of swear. Maybe just a little. This is what's going on up there, ladies and gentlemen. This is what's going on. Let's go into his next section, investing in people. The principles embodied in my agenda measure the true value of our economy, not in dollars and cents, but in the strength of our communities and the improvement to the quality of life of our people. By investing in people, we open the doors of economic mobility, create new pathways for long-term growth, and underwrite America's future economic stability. Again, underwrite America's future economic stability. That right there, ladies and gentlemen, that's what you call a subtle threat. I ain't saying Mr. Steyer meant it as a threat, but that is a subtle threat. These people will destabilize the whole country if they cannot get their way. And if you do not believe me, look at what they're doing to Venezuela right now. Look at what they have done to Syria. Look at what they did to Libya. Look at what they did to Iraq. Why the heck do you think North Korea won't give up its nuclear bombs? They're not stupid. But that's a subtle threat. Do what we want you to do. Get away from the socialism. Get away from the stuff that Europe's doing, or we will make your life hell. I'm not saying Mr. Steyer is saying that. I'm saying that I've seen language like this in what is often called conservative media, but it's not really conservative media, it's corporatist media. They've bound the two. So here's what he writes. Under my people over profits economic agenda, I will. Now mind you, this is four pages, ladies and gentlemen. This whole people over profits agenda or three values agenda thing that he wrote, four pages. Now, I'm blanking on his name presently. Who was the... There was a... He's already out of the race, too. There was a candidate who ran specifically because of climate change. And he put forward a 90-page proposal. A 90-page proposal for how he would deal with climate change. A 90-page proposal. This man is a billionaire. And he has an executive summary. An executive summary of what he wants to do. And he doesn't even have the full report. The man spent $47 million to get onto the debate stage. You telling me that he couldn't put together another $2 million to get people to actually put this thing together? You want to show me that you're for real, Mr. Steyer? Come out with a 200-page plan, man. Tell me what you are going to do. Don't make blatant, bland promises. That doesn't even go together. I said blatant and bland at the same time. It doesn't even work. But don't do it, because no one's going to believe you. Let's keep going. Under my People Over Profits economic agenda, I will, one, guarantee that Americans have 5 new constitutional rights. Oh, my. So this means he has already cleared these with the wealthy. This is a FDR moment, ladies and gentlemen. He's already cleared some of these with the wealthy. This is how afraid they're getting. 5 new constitutional rights. The right to health care. I mean, first and foremost, I can't stress this enough, ladies and gentlemen. A billionaire is saying that he will guarantee that Americans have 5 new constitutional rights. How can you say that knowing the political winds in Washington? Unless you know something that we don't. Go and get the book. There's 2 books that you really need to get, ladies and gentlemen. Dark Money and So Damn Much Money. Get both of those books and just consume them. Because what this man knows is what those books expose. The billionaires have their hands all in Washington. And it's clear from the language of this that he has secured some type of agreement with them to facilitate, to keep this, to facilitate some sense of victory for the ordinary people in order to stop this move left, to really strangle, to put a stranglehold on capitalism. He has secured some type of agreement to allow him to be able to write, under my People Over Profits economic agenda, I will guarantee. How many politicians say, I will guarantee anything? Nobody. I will guarantee that Americans have 5 new constitutional rights. The right to health care, the right to clean air and water, the right to a living wage, a livable wage, he writes, the right to an equal vote, and the right to a quality education. This man is telling you that he has already secured, and I mean the devil is in the details. I'd have to see what he means by all of this. He has went to the billionaires and said, either we do something or this country's going left quick. Because we're seeing the polls. We know what young people want. We know what they've been saying for the last 30 years. And now the chickens have come home to roost. You need to act now. And they said, we are willing to give you this. And that's what this is. To continue, government must work in partnership with all sectors of the economy to advance policies. This is how you know that this is coming directly from the billionaires. Governments must work in partnership with all sectors of the economy to advance policies and programs that effectively, equitably, and efficiently deliver services that promote upward mobility and provide economic opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, government must work in partnership with all sectors of the economy. The government's already working with all sectors of the economy to the detriment of the society. In other words, the government should not put strangleholds on the economy, on any sector. This is how you know that this is coming directly from the top of this society, from these billionaires. Now they want to negotiate because they see the storm gathering. Now they want to negotiate. You got them against the wall, ladies and gentlemen. What are you going to do about it? Continuing. Number 2. make our federal tax system more equitable. I will enact policies that ensure that all corporations and all income classes will pay their fair share. I will repeal the Trump tax cuts and institute a wealth tax. 1% on those whose net worth is above $32 million that will generate over $1 trillion for healthcare, education, environmental, and criminal justice programs. It will not continue to provide favorable treatment to the rich and powerful of the at the expense of low income. So I believe he meant I will not continue to provide favorable treatment to the rich and powerful at the expense of low income and middle class Americans. Ladies and gentlemen, now. If I'm not mistaken, Bernie Sanders' tax, wealth tax is 2% over $50 million. They come in at 1% at people making over $32 million. Now, here's the thing. He doesn't make it clear, whether or not this is, earned money. How am I looking to say this? He doesn't make it clear on if it's, if he's excluding or including dividend payments or, bonuses or what have you. But again, I pointed out to you again, ladies and gentlemen, this tells you how nervous these people are. Number three, I will allocate increased resources to public schools and social service programs address systemic gender and racial wealth disparities and invest in a multi-year effort to rebuild America's infrastructure, bridges, affordable housing, roads, ports, broadband network, airports, etc. that will expand business opportunities. That will expand business opportunities, generate good-paying jobs, and lead us to a renewable future. That will expand business opportunity. Do you notice a theme here? Government working with business on all sectors, and now we're doing this. Okay. Because don't forget, Bernie Sanders said he wants to implement, if I remember correctly, a WPA-style work program. Something that the wealthy have not been willing to do. But suddenly, this is where we're at. Continuing. I will provide a healthcare system that covers more Americans at a lower cost. I will repeal Trump's rollbacks to the Affordable Care Act, enable a strong public option, and institute insurance industry rate review. I will allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug costs and eliminate pay for delay contracts to lower the cost of prescription drugs. Ladies and gentlemen, again, I can't stress this enough. I know I've said it a number of times, but I got to say it again. This man is representing the wealthy, and this is how scared they are. See, because I don't know how many of you follow Professor Richard Wolff, Economic Update, but if you don't, please do, Democracy at Work. There is a lot of chatter, and before I continue with this, before I continue reading this, I want to go into a little bit of this. There's a lot of chatter that's going on right now. There's a lot of chatter online, and the wealthy... I've talked to you before about how the wealthy takes these wonderful polls to kind of gauge how we're all doing and what we're all thinking. Well, now the wealthy don't even need to do, like, massive polling, even though they still do. They can give millions of dollars to places like Google and other corporations that all they do then is just mine the internet. They mine the internet, and they look at chatter. And there's some chatter that's been popping up over the last couple of years. People have been looking up socialism. They've been looking up alternative economic systems, alternative economic theories. They've been interested in cooperatives. They've been interested in building up community around cooperatives and getting away from capitalism. People have been looking this stuff up, and these wealthy people know it. They know it. The world is not closed anymore. When you see him come out and say, I will do all these things that 10 years ago you were asking us to do, and we said no, that we were going to give you Obamacare without any of this stuff, it tells you that they are afraid. They are afraid, ladies and gentlemen. They're afraid. I will provide a healthcare system that covers more Americans at a lower cost. I will repeal Trump's rollbacks to the Affordable Care Act. Enable a strong public option. The wealthy wouldn't even entertain that back in 2009, in 2010. I will institute insurance industry rate review. I will allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug costs and eliminate pay-for-delay contracts to lower the cost of prescription drugs. None of this they were willing to give us. Oh. I don't know. I really don't know if you guys understand how powerful this is. Continuing. I will make major investments in higher education, worker training, and apprenticeship programs. Speaking too quickly here. To produce a highly trained, skilled, and educated workforce and meet the technological needs of our changing economy. Barack Obama asked for this, ladies and gentlemen. See, everyone's criticizing Barack Obama, but a lot of people don't remember what he actually tried to do before he got swallowed up. But he asked for that. They wouldn't even hand it to him. See, that's another thing that's going on. Barack Obama's getting paid all this money, but only, I've seen a few clips that have leaked out from what he's doing. And I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, Barack Obama's told these people. Barack Obama have told these people what the deal is. See, they didn't want to listen to him. They did not want to listen to him prior to Donald Trump. And they weren't going to listen to him with Donald Trump because everything was so good. Many of them still ain't listening. But there's a number of them that are. And they see it. They see what he's saying is true. So continuing, I will reduce the burden of student loan debt by guaranteeing 2 years of free college. Again, ladies and gentlemen, 2 years of free college. They didn't even want any free college. Let's negotiate. Guaranteeing 2 years of free college, refinancing student loans at lower interest rates, passing a student borrowers bill of rights, and forgiving the student loan debt of teachers and other public servants who have dedicated their time and energy to building our communities. That's garbage, but whatever. This is negotiating right here, because they see what people are saying. And then the final section is called Harness Innovation and Promote Competition. An American economy that is firing on all cylinders, out-competes and out-innovates others on the world stage. It adheres to the rule of law, respects its workers, seeks fair and open trade agreements, and is prepared to meet economic and environmental challenges at home and abroad. Mind you, the man hasn't even put the idea of climate change up here. But then again, this is profits over people. Ensuring fairness in a market-based economy requires the government to set the economic rules of the road, the guardrails for the economy to operate within also, he writes that. There are things that government does well, such as providing incentives and regulating the market, but it should not be relied on to be an economic engine. Even though these people have, they have showed that they are unwilling to be that economic engine. And they've done it twice now. It should not be relied upon to be an economic engine or the sole deliverer of services. Nobody is saying that it needs to be the sole deliverer of services. Even in Iraq, which was socialist, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, he took what the people wanted and used it against them. That was Saddam Hussein. The people wanted socialism. He gave them dictatorship. Because the U.S. liked that a lot better than a socialist regime that was actually democratic like that in Sweden. Oh, yeah, there's an interesting political history of Iraq that most people don't know. The U.S. did not like the idea of there being socialist concepts in the Middle East or in Africa or in South America. You can't rip off the people if they're socialist. Continuing. Under my people over profits economic agenda, I will harness innovation and promote competition by reviewing and enforcing existing and considering new antitrust regulations that ensure fair markets across all sectors and industries. I really don't believe that one's going to happen. I think that one's there just for good measure. Number two, declare on day one a climate change emergency and begin implementing the agenda outlined in my justice-centered climate plan to transition the United States to a green economy. Now, mind you, ladies and gentlemen, I have spoke on this before because, see, that sounds good to you. But I've spoken on this before about the whole idea of transitioning the United States to a green economy. A green economy, from a spiritual standpoint, is about decentralizing. It is about decentralizing. We are supposed to be decentralizing these economic systems. That's what a green technology revolution is supposed to be about. What he is talking about, guarantee it. I haven't even looked at his plan yet, and I can tell you what he's talking about. It's something that is going to benefit big business mostly. It's going to be a capitalist haven, which is going to be more destructive for the society. Because contrary to what he says about innovation, capitalism is not very innovative. It always needs to create things which perpetuates its power over the people who is trapped in its economic landscape. So it can't be innovative in a way that would allow those people to freely exercise their will. That stymies innovation. Because if you think about it, technology in and of itself is moving in a manner which is either going to restrict freedom or it's going to open up freedom. Capitalism says it must restrict freedom. It must always be in control. So what he's saying there about the plan to transition the United States to a green economy, it's going to benefit wealthier wealthier people and big industry. I will invest heavily in cutting-edge research and development. Incubate new businesses, entrepreneurs, and green industry sectors, restore America's climate leadership position across the globe, significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and create 4.6 million jobs annually along the way. Again, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, these people are scared. And finally, I will negotiate trade agreements with vital economic partners in emerging regions of the world to strengthen key domestic economic sectors and rebuild American national security relationships. These agreements will be negotiated in a manner that includes the voices and reflects the input of all stakeholders. I hate that word, stakeholders, because it never actually is true. Anytime when they say all stakeholders, they really don't mean everybody. Particularly environmental groups, indigenous populations, and labor unions. My administration will also rebuild our own institutions, respecting the knowledge and skills of career officials to forge and foster partnerships, networks, and collaborations that will protect American national interests, protect American leadership and value, and make us safer and more prosperous. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a ransom. This is a ransom note. I'm sorry, that's actually incorrect. But it is really it's a treaty of terms of agreement. These people are so frightened of the momentum of Bernie Sanders. See, because in 2016, they screwed him. They screwed him. They know they screwed him. They did it at every level. They screwed him. And this time, the force is too big. See, they had plausible deniability in 2016 because you didn't have alternative news sources that had their eyes on Bernie Sanders. This is the chessboard, ladies and gentlemen. This is the chessboard. You didn't have alternative news sources that really had their eyes on Bernie Sanders. The Young Turks kind of did, but as soon as, you know, Bernie Sanders went the way of the dodo, then they just quickly switched over and said, now we're going to be marching in lockstep, goose-stepping with Hillary Clinton. Which completely ripped apart their credibility, but whatever. This time, you had independent media sources who played a role in the progressive wave that happened in 2018. And it's building. They see the numbers of the people who are going to alternative news sources. Whether you're talking YouTube, blogs, websites. They know it's building. They see what people are talking about on Facebook. They know what side has the power and what side has the energy, the enthusiasm. They're scared. They're scared. They are scared. This may even be why they put Tulsi Gabbard back on stage. Because Tulsi Gabbard, for as much as good of a president as she would be, Tulsi Gabbard compared to Bernie Sanders is kind of a moderate. Economically and such, she's kind of a moderate. She may not be a capitalist, but there's a reason why libertarians and conservatives really, 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 really like her. Outside of the fact that she's former military. She's a moderate. But she's also the type of person who is willing to put her moderate side aside to do what's good for the nation. Which makes her a threat. That makes her a threat. They had to also exclude Tulsi Gabbard to, you know, position Warren, who they're hoping they're going to be able to leapfrog over Sanders. Right now, they're doing this huge push in places like the New York Times and MSNBC and CNN to push Warren ahead of Sanders. Warren is, you know, picking up momentum and you know, she is now leading in Iowa. Oh yeah, they have a plan, ladies and gentlemen. And their plan is try like hell to defeat Bernie Sanders prior to Super Tuesday. And I say prior to Super Tuesday because Super Tuesday, I think, is going to be the day when you see the match really start to pull away in favor of Sanders. I was actually looking at the schedule, the upcoming primary schedules. And it's a very interesting scene going into March. You should really look at the schedule. Because you have a couple of really big days that will be coming up. Which, just so I don't overspeak here, I'm working on pulling this up right now so I can tell you exactly what I saw. And I apologize, I did. That's exactly why I pulled it up, because I was thinking that I had something misconstrued, and I did. The timetable, I said going into March. I meant going into April. Going into April. So, Iowa, New Hampshire, Iowa's on the 3rd of February, New Hampshire is on the 11th of February, Nevada is on the 22nd, and then South Carolina is on the 29th. Now, I want to, you know, I was doing some quick research the other day because I was looking at these states and I was like, wait a minute. You know, out of all of these states, like, the only one that probably really represents America, and I mean demographically wise, is South Carolina. I was surprised to learn, though, Nevada does have a pretty decent mix of people. I think 67%, roughly 67%, it's over 65%, is white. Everybody else is kind of, you know, non-white. But the first two states are overwhelmingly white. Overwhelmingly white. And so, recently, after AOC came out and endorsed Bernie Sanders, there was a statement that was made, I think it was on CNN, where he questioned if some people might ask if Bernie Sanders is too urban. And that was a weird thing to say, until I looked at the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire both have like 85% plus percent of white people, and the majority of them probably don't know many black people, mainly because, well, when you have states that have that many white people, how many black and non-white people are you really gonna have? It might backfire in their face, though. But then you have Nevada, where that urban comment, it doesn't even matter. But if they can get Elizabeth Warren to score big for those two, that may be enough to turn South Carolina or Nevada definitely towards her. If she can get 3 out of 4, or maybe even 4 out of 4 going into what was typically called Super Tuesday, where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. You have 16 states up for grab. You have Alabama, American Samoa, Arkansas, California, huge state, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, California and Texas on the same day, Utah, Vermont, in Virginia, and then you also have all Democrats that are abroad will be also voting. If she can get 3 out of 4 or maybe a clean sweep, that might take some of these, which would probably likely go Sanders, and flip them to her. That's their goal. That's their goal. Puerto Rico is going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting. That's on March 8th. March 10th is another big state or big day where there's going to be a lot of states up for grabs. Hawaii, Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, big one especially for the black vote, Missouri, North Dakota, and Washington. Northern Marianas comes up on the 14th. Then March 17th, you have two big states that are definitely going to be watched closely. Florida, Ohio. You also have Illinois and Arizona. Georgia's on the 24th. For some reason, Puerto Rico also has their, Puerto Rico is not on the... Yeah, Puerto Rico has its Republican primary on the 29th. You know, I just realized something. I just realized that they have everybody listed here. And I'm sorry, Puerto Rico is not on the 8th for the Democrats. It would be on the 29th. So, sorry about that. But they're hoping to get them taken care of in these first four. And if they can do that, then they think they can have the wave going well enough towards Warren, where Bernie Sanders will drop out after Super Tuesday. The question is, will you let him? I'm going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to come back on the other side with a little segment, and then we'll see. Depends on how much time we have left. This is your brother, Brian Meredith. I'll see you on the other side.
The Democratic race for president may soon have a new candidate. CBS News has confirmed former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is actively working to get on the ballot in at least one state. The billionaire was asked about a possible run last week by Face the Nation moderator and CBS News senior foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan.
To be clear, are you completely closing the door to a 2020 run?
I put out a statement in March saying and outlining why I was not running.
That was March.
For president, and nothing's changed other than the calendar.
So you're kind of closing the door.
No, I didn't say that. It's just X number of months later, nothing's changed. You know, I have my reservations about the people running and the way they're campaigning and the promises they're making that they can't fulfill and their unwillingness to really admit what is possible and what isn't. And they're inconsistent.
Well, that's kind of a wily answer. Margaret Brennan is here now as Face the Nation celebrates its 65th anniversary. Happy anniversary. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what as you saw what Michael, we saw what Michael Bloomberg said there when he was here in September, he said he didn't see a place for himself in the race because he'd split votes with Joe Biden.
Right.
What if anything has changed?
He was sitting right there, Margaret, so answer very carefully.
I know, and he told you exactly that. I think what has changed is a desire to have what he put in that announcement, my voice heard in terms of he's very frustrated with the Democratic field. I know close advisors to him have been very frustrated, particularly with the lack of digital strategy not matching up to, say, where the Trump campaign is. By saying, maybe, by going this close, I mean, we've been to the brink with Mike Bloomberg before, third time now that we've had him say he might run. He's never gone this far before. And so he can make sure that he's shaping the agenda of who is out there and talking, whether or not he follows through with actually filing.
It's sometimes been said of Bloomberg that he might be able to win a general, but he could never win a Democratic primary. So on that primary front, where does he fit among the other candidates?
It's also been said that no New York billionaire could ever win the presidency, right? And so I think all the rules of the road have kind of been thrown out there. But Michael Bloomberg in the past, when he looked at running as an independent, as a third party, said that was never going to go anywhere. Here, he's in some ways, though, splitting possibly a vote with Joe Biden, maybe helping that center moderate Democrat have another voice. The party in this primary process has been pulled towards, as Mike Bloomberg said there, his frustration is that it's being pulled to the more progressive wing, to the Elizabeth Warrens, to the Bernie Sanders, people who they identify as populists more than Democrats. And there's a fear of that among Democratic donors who are more establishment, that they won't be able to be enthusiastic about that candidate if that's who the party goes with to run against President Trump.
As you saw what Michael, we saw what Michael Bloomberg said there when he was here in September, he said he didn't see a place for himself in the race because he'd split votes with Joe Biden.
Right.
What if anything has changed?
He was sitting right there, Margaret, so answer very carefully.
I know, and he told you exactly that. I think what has changed is a desire to have what he put in that announcement, my voice heard in terms of he's very frustrated with the Democratic field. I know close advisors to him have been very frustrated, particularly with the lack of digital strategy not matching up to, say, where the Trump campaign is. By saying, maybe, by going this close, I mean, we've been to the brink with Mike Bloomberg before, third time now that we've had him say he might run. He's never gone this far before. And so he can make sure that he's shaping the agenda of who is out there and talking, whether or not he follows through with actually filing.
It's sometimes been said of Bloomberg that he might be able to win a general, but he could never win a Democratic primary. So on that primary front, where does he fit among the other candidates?
It's also been said that no New York billionaire could ever win the presidency, right? And so I think all the rules of the road have kind of been thrown out there. But Michael Bloomberg in the past, when he looked at running as an independent, as a third party, said that was never going to go anywhere. Here, he's in some ways, though, splitting possibly a vote with Joe Biden, mm-hmm. maybe helping that center moderate Democrat have another voice. The party in this primary process has been pulled towards, as Mike Bloomberg said there, his frustration is that it's being pulled to the more progressive wing, to the Elizabeth Warrens, to the Bernie Sanders, people who they identify as populists more than Democrats. And there's a fear of that among Democratic donors who are more establishment, that they won't be able to be enthusiastic about that candidate if that's who the party goes with to run against President Trump.
Well, folks, yesterday we got the news that exactly nobody had been waiting for, and that is that former New York City mayor slash ninth richest person in the United States, Michael Bloomberg, is most likely jumping into the Democratic presidential race, and it is likely that he will file his papers to be on the ballot in the state of Alabama for their primary, which today is the deadline. So if he hasn't done it yet, maybe he's not going to do it. But here's the thing. And I think Bernie Sanders' campaign said it perfectly. They said, more billionaires seeking more political power surely isn't the change America needs. And that's exactly correct. Michael Bloomberg is a billionaire worth a little more than $52 billion. He's also the creator of the stop and frisk policy in New York, which he still seems to stand by. So automatically, even without the billions, supporting stop and frisk would be automatic disqualification in the eyes of most progressives. Excuse me, all progressives, most Democrats. But being a billionaire is also in and of itself at this point disqualifying. Because Bloomberg has no reason to get into this race other than the fact that he wants to protect his fortune. And he'll spend a fortune to protect his fortune, probably spend more on his presidential race than he would end up paying in taxes if Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren became president. That's the true irony here. He's willing to spend millions upon millions upon millions of dollars on his vanity campaign that will go nowhere rather than spending the exact same amount in taxes. That will actually help. It'll help schools. Maybe we won't have to cut school lunch programs. Maybe it could go towards Medicare for all or debt-free college or a Green New Deal. Maybe it could do something even more simple like repairing damaged roads and bridges across the country. But Bloomberg doesn't want his money going to that. No, 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 no. He wants his money going out there so more people know who he is. And so that maybe in the off chance every other candidate decides to randomly drop out, he could actually become the president of the United States. Folks, this is insane. Michael Bloomberg does not need to be in this race whatsoever. Neither does Tom Steyer. If you guys want to spend millions of dollars on something, spend it on something that matters. Not 2% in national polling. That's a waste of money. But they don't care. They don't want to pay more in taxes. Tom Steyer says maybe he does. Sure, whatever, I don't believe you. Bloomberg absolutely does not. And it had been hinted at earlier in this year that Bloomberg would stay out of the race so long as Biden looked like he was going to be the nominee, but now it doesn't look that way. Now it's Bernie and Warren kind of fighting it out for number one. And so Bloomberg decided, you know what, that means I'm going to have to pay more money each year. So instead of doing that, I'm going to pay a ton of money right now so that I don't have to pay any money next tax season. It's very stupid logic, but that is the logic that Bloomberg had in deciding that, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and throw my billionaire hat in the ring because, sure, everybody loves billionaires today, right? Bloomberg is out of touch, not just with the American public, but apparently with reality as well. Nobody wants another billionaire running for president. But Bloomberg is ignoring all of that because he doesn't want to pay more in taxes. Thanks for watching, everybody. And don't forget, if you like what you see here, like, comment, share, and subscribe to our channel. And now you can also become a member of Ring of Fire and get exclusive early access to certain Ring of Fire videos all throughout the week. Just click on the little join button right below the video.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Brian Meredith. Welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast segment. So I'm adding this on November 8th, 2019. And actually, I apologize. Today is November 9th, 2019. And I already had the episode already recorded. I was just getting done putting it together when I learned about Michael Bloomberg's entry into the race. Ladies and gentlemen, the elite are scared. They are scared. We've touched on why this is, but I'm going to go in an entirely different direction, because with the books that I've been reading recently, with the books that I've been finding recently, reading, getting myself acquainted with, my mindset has begun to evolve a little bit. About 5 years ago, 2014, I discovered, well, actually I got to go before that, 2013, I discovered this man named Dave Emery. Now, I'm not vouching for the guy, but I like his radio show, because at least in the older days, I still like it today too, but he makes you think. And so in 2013, a bunch of his stuff was up on archive.org, and I would go to archive.org and I would just download a bunch of it and listen to it, and I found some really interesting books listening to his stuff. But in some of his old stuff, this guy's been on radio since the 70s, he mentioned this woman named Mae Brussel. And it wasn't until 2014 that I was able to actually look her up and find her. And at that point, most of her archival work was online. This woman was fascinating, and that's to say the least. She came from a wealthy family who clearly didn't want for anything. And I say clearly didn't want for anything because she had a lot of time to dedicate to this, quote, hobby of hers, which was doing massive amounts of research and then condensing it down into this brilliant radio show called World Watchers International. She did a couple of named shows before that, but World Watchers International is what she really became well known for. She died of cancer in, I think it was 88. I think it was 88. And but she really helped me to understand a lot of the interconnectivity, at least of the time, of the people who were involved in, like, the Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, the RFK assassination, and then these business elements that were tied to the Reagan administration. And if she had lived, I've often said I wish she had lived, because she's another one that I was like, man, if she could have just lived for like 11 more years, man, I would have loved to see what she would have dug up for the First World Trade Center bombing, what she would have dug up for the war in Iraq, what she would have dug up, you know, for Bill Clinton. I mean, the woman was good at what she did, and her listeners were massively, massively engaged. And so she introduced me to a lot of networking ideas with the power elite. Recently, there's been a couple of books that have come out which have further talked about those power elites. And I only have one of them. I have Globalists. But there's multiple other ones. I actually just got a new one called Plutocrats, which is, I'm only It's an audio book that I've been listening to, but I'm only about an hour, 2 hours into it, maybe. And it's a little frightening, so if you get it, prepare your mind. Anyway. What became very clear to me from listening to people like Mae Russell and reading these books and what have you, what became clear to me is that there are obviously factions in the political world. Everyone knows that. But there's also factions in the elite. And, you know, I've mentioned it before. The brilliant 13-hour long, I know it seems like I'm getting paid to talk to you about it, but it really is brilliant, 13-hour long podcast episodes on the Roman Empire, that makes it really, really clear that those factions can fight, and that those fights can spill into the street and turn deadly. I think the JFK assassination was a quintessential example of a elite fight that turned deadly. That fight was over the direction of the country. When FDR implemented the New Deal, he pretty much looked at his class, put quotation marks around that, his class, and said, this is how the society is going to run. If you don't like it, there were prosecutions that happened because of the Great Depression, and he went after some powerful people to make sure that they would abide by this new agreement. It was only after his death, I think it was really going on during his life anyway, but that we saw that the fight and it's not fair to say that it came out after his death, because there were some, there were absolutely fights and struggles and what have you. But with Eisenhower, I think Eisenhower was able to tamp it down because he was such a big figure. One of the greatest stories about Eisenhower is that he almost ran as a Democrat. Both parties were courting him, and he went with the Republicans instead of the Democrats. But within 15 years of, I mean, it was clear that there were still fights and struggles. The McCarthy thing was all about the elite fighting, and that fight falling and spilling into the academic world and spilling into Hollywood and spilling into all of these other places that hadn't really been victimized by an upper elite fight in a long while. You know, there were always mob problems and what have you, but those were more middle class problems more so than elite problems. You know, the elite might have their hands in the deal, but you never really could connect it to them. But what's really clear from these books is that starting in really at the end of the 1950s, but really like got going into the 60s, that's when it was really noticeable, was there was this huge reversing that was trying to happen. So most of your neoconservatives, especially when you start climbing the class ladder, these people looked back to a time before FDR. They wanted a society that worked similar to the society, you know, that existed before FDR said, here's the New Deal. Now, of course, I have discovered that a person by the name of James Buchanan, I believe his name was, that he picked out a year and he said 1900. But these people wanted to go back. This is why you always heard conservatives back in the 1990s talking about when times were good back then. They never say when, but back then. Their back then was before the New Deal. And with Kennedy trying to advance, like, you know, Graham Elwood did this great video on Kennedy's speech that nobody has heard. Kennedy talking about national health care and pushing national health care. I have known many older people, and, you know, this is more like 20 years ago than now. But those people who remember, actually, I can say now too, yes, because I've talked to people who remember Kennedy. You know, they're older now. They're 60s, 70s, 75, 80. And many of them, unless they were staunch Republicans, really do admire him. And it's very clear to see why, because he was trying to advance the New Deal still. He was trying to advance the New Deal. And his death, I am really starting to believe, had to do with killing components of the group of people that were still holding up the New Deal. So, like, Ted Kennedy was one of the last people holding up the old coalition for the New Deal. And when he passed away, the New Deal coalition was out. It's done. Enter Bernie Sanders. Enter Bernie Sanders. See, ladies and gentlemen, it is becoming very, very clear. It is becoming very, very clear that these people, they fear Bernie Sanders because he is a New Deal Democrat. I said to a friend of mine, military guy, ex-military, staunch Trump supporter, him and I, when we're not arguing about politics, we're talking, and he had posted something that I thought was crazy, and it had to do with one of the candidates, and I told him, you know, this was crazy, it's not true. And he asked me, who was I voting for? And I told him, the only person with a historical perspective, that's important, ladies and gentlemen, a historical perspective, meaning the person knows how we got to where we're at. Not talking ideologically, talking from a historical standpoint, know how we got to where we're at. When in the past we have been in the same position, and what we have done right and wrong in order to get out of that position. The only person with that kind of historical perspective is Bernie Sanders. Only person is Bernie Sanders. He said, well, you know, I can't do it. He's a socialist. I can't do it. And I said to him, I'm a socialist. And Bernie Sanders is no socialist. He's a democratic socialist because to say that you're a New Deal Democrat today is like saying that you blank puppies. It's not good, okay? People don't like it. So he's a democratic socialist. It pops, but the man is not a socialist. He's a New Deal Democrat. And that's the point, ladies and gentlemen. You have a new generation of rich people in this country. This line just completely shivers my bones every time I think about it. These people, they're younger, some of them. I mean, some of them aren't so young. But these people have a caveman mentality. And I don't mean that they're like cavemen, but I mean they really do have a caveman dog-eat-dog mentality. In the book Plutocrats, she quotes, this is a woman who is, she covers the elite, she covers billionaires, millionaires, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank. She covers these people. She knows these people. And she quotes one of these people as saying, we eat what we kill. We eat what we kill. These people have no allegiance to a society. They have no allegiance. They don't really have an allegiance to a lot of them, not all of them. A lot of them don't even have an allegiance to their families. That's what's pretty clear about even just the first couple of hours of listening to this book. They have no allegiance to any society. And yet, one of them has the audacity to say capitalism will work, which I've heard this before. I've mentioned this in earlier episodes of this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, that rich people were saying back in the 1800s, give it 20 or 30 years, 40 years. You know, you're going to be surprised. Everything's going to be great. It's going to work out well. It didn't happen. But you hear these people saying the same thing. The same thing. They have been treated like they are the saviors of the planet for the last 40 years. They've been treated like they were the saviors of the planet. And that's the wrong way to be, because their egos are already big as it is. They think they're gods. And now suddenly you got this guy coming along, riling up the nobodies. Rounding up the nobodies. And telling them all this great stuff. This is another reason why you need to get the Dan Carlin's Death Throes of a Republic. Whew, man, I love that title. Because, and I say this to you legitly, family. These people want to stop Bernie Sanders. And I'm not confident how far. I'm not confident that they have a limit to how far they'll go to stop him. The reason why I'm really doing this, obviously, is because of hearing about Michael Bloomberg getting into the race. That just tells me how absolutely desperate these people are. I keep telling you, I'll get to that in a second. The reason why I'm doing this, obviously, is because of Michael Bloomberg getting into the race. But the other reason why I'm doing this is because you need to be prepared, ladies and gentlemen. You need to be prepared. See, this isn't about electing Bernie Sanders, electing, you know, progressives and socialists. There are a number of socialists actually running for the House of Representatives. Electing progressives and socialists at the local level, the state level. It's not just about that anymore, ladies and gentlemen. It's about starting groups in your community to address the problems of your community, but also to remain politically connected. That's what it's about now. That's what it's about now. We have to remain politically connected. We have to actually remain politically astute. And ladies and gentlemen, I got to tell you, that may mean starting up new newspapers, because a lot of your locally, regionally owned newspapers are owned by conservatives. Very few of them are owned by progressive-minded people, meaning you're going to have to start a new generation of that. I mean, this is a renewal time, ladies and gentlemen. We have to reset the agenda. See, this is why they're so afraid. Because Bernie Sanders inspired a lot of people. And he inspires a lot of people. This time, it was AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rokana, and a few others. Not to even talk about the number of people that have said that they've run for local councils, city councils, state legislatures, and various other offices, all because of Bernie Sanders. Not even talking about them. There are a million people hitting the streets for him right now. These are numbers that even Barack Obama couldn't match. These people are frightened. Now, I've been telling you for the longest time, ladies and gentlemen, that these people are lying to you about the polls. I've been telling you that they are that they have internal polling that is scaring the living hell out of them. Why? Because despite, and by the way, you may ask me, how do you know this? Do I know it directly? No. But I can tell you that there are numerous agencies, private agencies, that poll people, that people will, you know, companies, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, will walk up and say, we'll give you $5 million. We need you to poll 500,000 people to find out this information for us. And they'll do it. The reason I know, further than anything else, though, that their internal polling is telling them this, is because of how hard they're selling Elizabeth Warren, they're selling Pete Buttigieg, they're selling, I'm sorry, Pete Buttigieg. That's a, I always want to put a J there instead of a G. How hard they're selling these two. And the mere fact that they had to go and get Michael Bloomberg off of the shelf tells you just how bad it is according to their polls, ladies and gentlemen. There has been a couple of things that have happened over the last couple of weeks which tells me just how bad it's getting. I've been, obviously, I listen to the broadcast almost every single day that they publish one. And they reported on the move to deprive young people, students, in multiple states of their ability to vote. Now, not to like say, well, you just can't vote. No, to change the type of ID that they need. To make it harder for them to vote if they live on campus, but they're from out of state, to stop campuses from actually having voting sites on them. Why? Because they know. They know. Especially, you know, a couple of the states were swing states, if I'm not mistaken. One of them was Texas. Texas is increasingly turning purple. They've been able to, the rich, wealthy oil men down there have been able to buy their prestige and influence for a couple of generations. And that prestige and influence is wearing off as times are getting harder. But among young people, among college age kids who are the most fanatically and trust me, look up the word fanatically. It's not as bad as you think it is. But they're the most fanatically engaged with Bernie Sanders. They love him. Even more so than the love that Barack Obama got. And Barack Obama, it was said, was pretty much elected. He was the first millennial. I mean, technically, he was a baby boomer. Might have been after a baby boomer. He would have been after baby boomer. But anyway, he was the first elected millennial president. They're more into Bernie Sanders than they were into Barack Obama. What does that mean? They said that it was first-time voters, young people, that put Barack Obama into the White House. It was the lack of them in 2016, supposedly, that put Trump into the White House. Go going by their own analyses, they got a problem. Because even Trump doesn't match the number of first-time voters that are coming out to support Bernie Sanders. Trump has no young support like that of Bernie Sanders. And this is where I turn back to the internal polls. They know this. They know all these things about first-time voters. They know all these things about young people. They were printing them in 2016. Go back and look. During the primaries, the New York Times didn't want to give Bernie Sanders any positive coverage. But they had to admit a couple of things. And among them was that Bernie Sanders outstretched Clinton dramatically with his young support. Or his support from younger voters and first-time voters. They had to admit that. So I say to you again, they know, their internal polls are telling them, Bernie Sanders is the guy. You can give me as many external polls as you want. Bernie Sanders is the guy that everyone's trying to beat. Enter Mike Bloomberg. Why? The first segment of this episode dealt with, God, I can't even remember his name now. What is his name? Tom Steyer. The first segment was about Tom Steyer running and why the wealthy was starting to negotiate with us. With Michael Bloomberg entering the race, one, they know Michael Steyer isn't even trying to catch on. And Michael Steyer may indeed be a progressive man. That could have been their attempt. But now they know what? They know that Michael Bloomberg, people have been asking Michael Bloomberg to run for president since 2008. As an independent, mostly. They need somebody who's a quick talker, who can beat down people, who doesn't care about anybody but his own egotistical, narcissistic self. Michael Bloomberg, they like him because he doesn't care what anyone else thinks. So he'll take no prisoners. That's why they want him up there on that stage. That's why they want him running for president, should I say. But it also says something about how desperate they're getting. Joe Biden isn't catching on. And if Michael Bloomberg's entering the race right now, it tells you that Elizabeth Warren isn't as strong a candidate as they keep saying she is. If Michael Bloomberg is getting in the race right now, Elizabeth Warren isn't as strong of a candidate as they keep saying she is. This reminds me of 2008 all over again. Ladies and gentlemen, most of you don't even really remember the primary season of 2008. Going into Iowa. Going into Iowa. The coverage, yeah, there was talk about Barack Obama. They weren't even talking. They weren't even trying to talk about John Edwards. They weren't even trying. He was the outside candidate. Maybe he was part of that New Deal coalition, you know, that doesn't exist much anymore. But everything was Hillary Clinton. Everything was great. She was winning. Life was good. Here comes Iowa. And here comes Barack Obama in number one in the first place. And there's John Edwards, who had pretty much been frozen out. I'm not saying he was completely frozen out. But he was beloved in 2004. Some people believe he had the nomination stolen from him in order for Kerry to win. So, yeah, the Democrats, they've done this before. He was number two. Barack was number one. He was number two, and I remember precisely, I was watching CNN, and CNN said probably the most disappointing, one of the commentators said, probably one of the most disappointing facts of the night is Hillary Clinton finished third. They had to know from their internal polling that she was not doing as well as they said, which would make sense because guess what? They were pushing her like she was winning. The same thing was sort of happening in 2016. Do not get it twisted, ladies and gentlemen. Like, progressives don't even want to think about this. They keep trying to say that it was an accident that Donald Trump got all that coverage. Oh, it was because of ratings. It was because of rate. Bull. Bull. They wanted Donald Trump rather than Hillary Clinton. They just didn't know what a mess they were going to get. Their internal polling is telling them Bernie Sanders is leading in Iowa. Their internal polling is telling them at least that that Sanders is tied in New Hampshire, which, by the way, that's another reason why I believe they pulled Elizabeth Warren off the shelf. I forgot. Bernie Sanders trounced. I forgot all about this. He trounced Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. Trounced her. Took her to school in New Hampshire. Absolutely took her to school. And I'm starting to wonder if some of the people who they have running this year, the reason why they put them up to run was to try to cut away at Sanders' base so he wouldn't win as many primary states. I wonder that. Now, maybe that's just me being overly conspiratorial. But I really do wonder that. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, really? She is sort of a progressive when she wants to be, but she isn't Bernie Sanders progressive. But I guess that's for another time. The billionaires are scared, ladies and gentlemen. That's all there is to it. I know this was a long way, you know, to go in saying all this, and this is going to be a long episode. I have one more section coming up, and then that'll be it. This is your brother, Ryan Mayor Deese. I will talk to you on the other side.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue the hour with world-renowned linguist, political dissident Noam Chomsky, who spoke last night here in Boston at the Old South Church.
I want to make a couple of remarks below about the severe difficulty of maintaining and instituting democracy, the powerful forces that have always opposed it, the achievements of somehow salvaging and enhancing it, and the significance of that for the future. But first, a couple of words about the challenges that we face, which you heard enough about already and you all know about. I don't have to go into them in detail. To describe these challenges as extremely severe would be an error. The phrase does not capture the enormity of the kinds of challenges that lie ahead. And any serious discussion of the future of humanity must begin by recognizing a critical fact that the human species is now facing a question that has never before arisen in human history, a question that has to be answered quickly. Will human society survive for long? Well, as you all know, for 70 years we've been living under the shadow of nuclear war. Those who've looked at the record can only be amazed that we've survived this far. time after time, it's come extremely close to terminal disaster, even minutes away. It's kind of a miracle that we've survived. Miracles don't go on forever. This has to be terminated and quickly. The recent nuclear posture review of the Trump administration dramatically increases the threat of conflagration, which would in fact be terminal for the species. We may remember that this nuclear posture review was sponsored by Jim Mattis, who was regarded as too civilized to be retained in the administration. Gives you a sense of what can be tolerated in the Trump, Pompeo, Bolton world. Well, there were three major arms treaties, the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, the INF treaty, intermediate nuclear forces, the New START treaty. The U.S. pulled out of the ABM treaty in 2002. And anyone who believes that anti-ballistic missiles are defensive weapons is deluded about the nature of these systems. The U.S. has just pulled out of the INF treaty, established by Gorbachev and Reagan in 1987, which sharply reduced the threat of war in Europe, which had very quickly spread. The background of that signing of that treaty was the demonstrations that you just saw depicted on the film. Massive public demonstrations were the background for leading to a treaty that made a very significant difference. It's worth remembering that and many other cases where significant popular activism has made a huge difference. The lessons are too obvious to enumerate. Well, the Trump administration has just withdrawn from the INF treaty. The Russians withdrew right afterwards. If you take a close look, you find that each side has a kind of a credible case saying that the opponent has not lived up to the treaty. For those who want a picture of how the Russians might look at it, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the major journal on arms control issues, had a lead article a couple of weeks ago by Theodore Postol pointing out how dangerous the U.S. installations of anti-ballistic missiles on the Russian border, how dangerous they are and can be perceived to be by the Russians. Notice on the Russian border, tensions are mounting on the Russian border. Both sides are carrying out provocative actions. We should, in a rational world, what would happen would be negotiations between the two sides with independent experts to evaluate the charges that each is making against the other to lead to a resolution of these charges, restore the treaty. That's a rational world, but it's unfortunately not the world we're living in. No efforts at all have been made in this direction, and they won't be unless there is significant pressure. Well, that leaves the New START treaty. The New START treaty has already been designated by the figure in charge, who has modestly described himself as the greatest president in American history. He gave it the usual designation of anything that was done by his predecessors, the worst treaty that ever happened in human history. We've got to get rid of it. If, in fact, this comes up for renewal right after the next election, and a lot is at stake, a lot is at stake, and whether that treaty will be renewed. It has succeeded in very significantly reducing the number of nuclear weapons to a level way above what they ought to be, but way below what they were before, and it could go on. Well, meanwhile, global warming proceeds on its inexorable course. During this millennium, every single year, with one exception, has been hotter than the last one. There are recent scientific papers, James Hansen and others, which indicate that the pace of global warming, which has been increasing since about 1980, may be sharply escalating and may be moving from linear growth to exponential growth, which means doubling every couple of decades. We're already approaching the conditions of 125,000 years ago when the sea level was about roughly 25 feet higher than it is today, with the melting, the rapid melting of the Antarctic huge ice fields, that point might be reached. The consequences of that are almost unimaginable. I mean, I won't even try to depict them, but you can figure out quickly what that means. Well, meanwhile, while this is going on, you regularly read in the press euphoric accounts of how the United States is advancing in fossil fuel production. It's now surpassed Saudi Arabia. We're in the lead of fossil fuel production. The big banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and others, are pouring money into new investments in fossil fuels, including the most dangerous, like Canadian tar sands. This is all presented with great euphoria, excitement. We're now reaching energy independence. We can control the world, determine the use of fossil fuels in the world. Barely a word on what the meaning of this is, which is quite obvious. It's not that the reporters, commentators don't know about it, that the CEO of the banks don't know about it. Of course they do. But these are kind of institutional pressures that just are extremely hard to extricate themselves from. You can put yourself in the, try to put yourself in the position of the, say, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, the biggest bank, which is spending large sums in investment in fossil fuels. He certainly knows everything that you all know about global warming. It's no secret. But what are the choices? Basically, he has two choices. One choice is to do exactly what he's doing. The other choice is to resign and be replaced by somebody else who'll do exactly what he's doing. It's not an individual problem. It's an institutional problem, which can be met, but only under tremendous public pressure. We've recently seen very dramatically how the solution can be reached. A group of young people, Sunrise Movement, organized, got to the point of sitting in congressional offices, aroused some interest from the new progressive figures who were able to make it to Congress under a lot of popular pressure. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, joined by Ed Markey, actually placed the Green New Deal on the agenda. That's a remarkable achievement. Of course, it gets hostile attacks from everywhere. It doesn't matter. It's a couple of years ago, it was unimaginable that it would be discussed. As a result of the activism of these group of young people, it's now right in the center of the agenda. It's got to be implemented in one form or another. It's essential for survival, maybe not in exactly that form, but some modification of it. Tremendous change achieved by the commitment of a small group of young people. That tells you the kind of thing that can be done. Meanwhile, the doomsday clock of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists last January was set at 2 minutes to midnight. That's the closest it's been to terminal disaster since 1947. The announcement of the settlement, of the setting, mentioned the two major familiar threats, the threat of nuclear war, which is increasing, threat of global warming, which is increasing further, and it added a third for the first time, the undermining of democracy. That's the third threat, along with global warming and nuclear war. And that was quite appropriate, because functioning democracy offers the only hope of overcoming these threats. They're not going to be dealt with by major institutions, state or private, acting without massive public pressure, which means that the means of democratic functioning have to be kept alive, used the way the Sunshine Movement did it, the way the great mass demonstration in the early 80s did it, and the way we continue today.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that will do for today's episode. As always, I thank you for being here with me, for spending your time with me. It was another long one. It wasn't a short one. So I hope it was worth your time. As we move through next year, I will have, obviously, some news on my forthcoming podcast, which I've been promising you guys for a while. And I will also work towards tightening this one up. I must admit, I have thought about just setting this one aside and not doing anything with it, you know, just letting it go. But you know, I have a love affair with this type of history. And as much as I'd like to say that, you know, I'm one in 50 voices commentating in this manner, I'm not. And that historical perspective, which is drastically missing out of a lot of people's commentaries, you know, a lot of people, they can talk about history as far as 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even some of them up to 20 years ago. But they don't really talk about it from the standpoint of 100 years ago and connecting the labor strikes of 125 years ago to where we're at today and the thinking of today's oligarchic elite, connecting it to the thinking of the oligarchic elite from 125 years ago. Most of these folks that are commentating, and I love them because they're all doing their little niches and I like what they're doing, but very few of them still are making these broad connections. Most of them aren't familiar with the union struggles of the early 1900s, the late 1800s. Now, I'm not saying that I can rattle off all these names of union, you know, war battles, because there were some battles that went on, man. You talk about thugs. These were European thugs that came in and just eviscerated communities, just destroyed communities because they were paid to do so. I'm not saying that I can list those battles one by one. I can't do that. But what I can do is I can see why that picture was forming. It had to do with the way of life. And in that broad concept, you know, I used to listen to a bunch of podcasts, a number of podcasts, a couple of them, really, a couple of years ago. There used to be a lot more of them on, like, 10 years ago, and now there's barely any of them. Like, everything is so political that nobody's looking at division. But I used to listen to these podcasts where the primary structure of the show was built around the way that we were going to live. How are we going to live? What was our cultural aims going to be about? And ultimately, I love this. This was fascinating because I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. Conservatives talk about it, but they do it in a very negative way most of the time. It's almost confrontational, which I was talking with a man who is a moderate conservative from the 70s. So, like, he's an outlier today. And his biggest thing was that he was an educator, so he was willing to learn. And he was willing to believe that not everything that he believed, you know, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, is correct today. Now, the man, if I remember correctly, was in his early 70s. So, you know, to talk about 35, 40 years ago, 40 years ago particularly would have been when Reagan got voting in, and he voted for Reagan. To be able to say that what I believed back then, and he said it to me, not in so many words, but he did say it when we were talking, that he was willing to listen, and he was willing to consider that he was wrong. Unfortunately, it took him to the point when, you know, he was not very active anymore, but he realized that a lot of what was said in the time period wasn't for the best of the country in the long haul. And that's where we're kind of, those type of programs that look at where the country's going in 20, 30, 40 years, those type of programs don't really exist. Or if they do, they're very limited. So, for instance, one of the podcasts I used to listen to was called Extra Environmentalist Podcast. Now, you can still get most of their shows online. I don't believe their website's up. I just tried to go to their website about a week ago because I wanted to find an old episode, and I couldn't find their website. So I don't believe their website's up anymore, but you can still get their episodes on like Podbeam and stuff. So, you know, you can go out there and get it. It's called the Extra Environmentalist Program. And there was another one that I used to listen to like 8-9 years ago. I can't remember that one though. That one was really interesting because for the longest time it was two people. And I kind of, when the other person stepped away, I wasn't happy because the show kind of switched, and the combination was way better. And they used to do a lot of shows like on location. And of course you're like, well, doing a show on location isn't that hard. But it wasn't about broadcasting it live. What they would do is they would go to locations and they would record these shows talking about the location and how it fit into their broader vision for the world. And I think it was called the New Urbanism. I think that was the title of the podcast. But how it fit into their new vision for the world. And like one episode I remember, they were walking through this mall that used to be really, you know, bustling, and now half of the stores are closed. And they connected all of that to the falling of the middle class, the destruction of the the destruction caused by the consumer first culture. And when I say consumer first, I don't mean the person, I mean the action. So it was very interesting. And you just don't see many podcasts like that. Now, most of the podcasts that I do aren't tailored for that. Most of the episodes that I do are tailored to confront some way of thinking that is completely not born from history. So we need to just scrap that. And we need to realize that that's just, you know, not positive for us. But there will have to be a discussion of vision. And to discuss vision, you got to have some organization. So next year is a major, major year. Next year is a major, major year. I know most of you are getting ready for the the election, but it's a bigger year than that. Some scientists found that when you look at parties that won the White House on the 20th year, those parties set the agenda for the next 20 years. Those parties set the agenda for the next 20 years. And it's kind of ironic because, you know, I look at history now through that lens. And I heard this like 25 years ago. And when, as I have grown up and I've watched people's actions, it seems that conservatives went all out to steal the year 2000. They went all out. Now, I've always been the type of person that thought, well, they weren't going to steal 2008 because, one, people were looking for them to do it, and that might have caused revolution in the street. Two, they had to deal with Barack Obama, who was very, very popular, and their candidate that year was, like, you know, milk toast, wasn't going to work, meaning he was boring, not that he was white. And not only was he boring, but he had changed so dramatically because of the money in the party that he wasn't even the same candidate that he was in 2000. So I've always been the type that, well, they couldn't have really stolen 2008. But then something, you know, like a couple of months ago, I was thinking, I go, well, wait a minute. If that 20th year is correct, they wouldn't want to steal 2008. Nor would they want to steal 2012. I wouldn't even say that they wanted to steal 2016. However, for the wealthy, I've made the argument before that the reason why they stole, that they worked to elect Donald Trump in 2016, or any Republican, to be honest with you, was because of incrementalism. They saw what Barack was doing. He was setting Clinton up to take Obamacare and to expand it, maybe put it into Medicare for all, maybe bring about universal health care. That's what was happening. And they said, no, we're not letting that happen. But if it is true that 2020 sets the agenda for until 2040, ladies and gentlemen, then the actions that have been being taken to suppress voters makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. It's a big year. I believe it's a big year. It's a big year astrologically. If you don't know what I'm talking about, do some research on the astrological components that are going to be coming together, that have come together over the last 2 years. We are getting ready. We may even be into it now. We are in a long-term pattern that every single time when this pattern comes up, this alignment of planets come up, you have dramatic reorganization of the world. We have dramatic reorganization of the world. And so, I've said it before and I'll say it again, the wealthy know this. They're not stupid. And let me actually back that up a little bit. The older wealthy know it. These newer guys, these younger guys, these guys are, most of them are too egotistical. They know stuff. And some of them may even be good with astrology because a lot of them are mathematicians. And astrology is just math. That's all it is. It's math. Math and interpretation. You got to use some intuition with it, but it's math. These people may be too egotistical to understand what they're looking at, even when they themselves are doing it. So, they may not understand what 2020 means from an astrological standpoint, but it's a big year, ladies and gentlemen. It is a huge year. 2020 through 2025 is going to set the agenda, not just for the next 20 years, but on the long term, it's going to be for the next 60 years, for the next 70 years. And America will live and die with the choices that it makes over the coming 5-6 years. I'm not joking here. I'm not joking here. So, you know, get ready, get active, get activated, and get prepared. Because all of us are going to have to be engaged to make sure that we have the type of future that we want. And there's going to be some aspects of that future that you're not going to be able to avoid. Like the whole reparations thing. I haven't touched on it much, ladies and gentlemen, but that's because I know it's a certainty. That is going to have to be addressed by the colonial powers, the former colonial powers, even as China rises, because China, well, China is going, China's rising right now, but China's going to have to prove that it's not like its Eurasian cousins, or else, there is two books, the one, I believe it was the In the Shadow of the American Century, and then the other one was American Theocracy, which, you know, if you're going to get that book, I really love the beginning of the book because it gives you a nice history of oil and connects history, particularly colonization and imperialism, to energy sources. And what is evident, both of these books make it very apparent, what is evident, is that the lifespan, the modern lifespan of hegemony continues to shrink. As it was said in, I mean, the other book, American Theocracy, guys, is like 10, 11 years old, maybe a little bit older. So it wasn't thinking, the author wasn't necessarily, well, he was kind of thinking that we were on the cusp of losing hegemony over the world. But as was stated in The Shadow of the American History, America, if the year that he has picked is correct, which is 2030, if it is correct, America's century would have only lasted, it would have lasted less than a century. It would have lasted less than 100 years. So China, in other words, in the standpoint of my ancestry, African ancestry, China has even less time to prove itself to be an accelerator of democracy. Hear what I just said. It has even less time to prove itself to be an accelerator of democracy. America thought that it could talk about democracy and do dirty work. The cosmos don't work that way. They keep the score. And it lost its privilege quickly. China will do the same thing. It'll last a generation and then fall. So what it is doing to promote democracy inside of its borders will have fundamental consequences to how it is able to administrate outside of its borders. And it's a very authoritarian culture. That said, they believe more so than anybody else in the cosmos and fate. And I'll just leave it there because they know exactly what that is. But I'm going to get out of here, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. If you have any questions, thank you for joining me. Sorry. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. You can always just, you know, look at the cover of every episode, and blue at the bottom is my email address. Just contact me and I'd love to hear from you. This is your brother, Brian Meredith. I will see you on the next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places.
where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.